Hello, welcome to another episode of Unpacking Neuroqueerness. First episode in, I want to say, 6 months, roughly. My co-host X and I just made a film, little documentary recently. I'll link it at the bottom. It's called Neurodivergent Stories. We had a really great time making this documentary. Really wanted to talk about everything that I've talked about and that we've talked about on this podcast before, but really summarizing it into like a film, and we'll get into how it came about and all that.
We'll also probably be going on tangents because that is what this podcast is about. That is what you have come to know us for, and we have to give it to you. You know, we can't really help it. I would like to start off with questions since, you know, it's your documentary. On this podcast specifically, you often talk about how outside perceptions of neurodivergent individuals contribute to common misconceptions and how that influences discussions about neurodiversity. You do it extensively on this podcast, and I'm very grateful to be a part of that discussion. Were there particular topics you decided to focus on to avoid things you'd see previously as external narratives of neurodivergent experiences?
That's a good question. Thank you. Yeah, I was thinking about that, you know, when I had the idea of doing the project and everything, and I wanted to make sure that I phrased the prompt. I wanted to make sure that I put it in a way where people were comfortable expressing just themselves from the gut, from what they're feeling, instead of trying to script or trying to fit something. I didn't want it to be too vague because I know for a lot of us it's helpful to have an idea of what exactly you're going to be talking about when it comes to something like the neurodivergent experience. I knew that I wanted it to be, like, I didn't want people to be too lost either. And then so it was actually X gave me a great idea of having these little questions, sort of like optional questions for people to respond to, just kind of give them some guidance. One way that you could talk about your experience, but I remember telling them in the email that the questions were strictly optional. I also didn't want them to feel like they had to follow something.
That would be beside the point of the entire project.
Yeah, exactly. So when I went to prepare the questions, I remember focusing a lot on things that aren't usually shown in mainstream TV and media. Things like, for example, sensory things, such, especially related to food. Things like masking, but just like the internal experience of masking. I think that is definitely something that, if I had to name the thing that's definitely not talked about barely at all in the mainstream world, is definitely masking, because masking is such an internal experience.
To that point, masking not from the, again, external mm-hmm. ways that people see it, but the strong, small details from within that are completely different from what people see, correct?
Yeah, exactly. Everything that goes on in your mind, particularly, I guess, in the example of autism, is you get so focused on, for me, I guess, at least, I would get really worried about how is the other person interpreting what I'm saying, because I know that for me, I'm putting the emphasis in the word. But I know that a lot of people, particularly neurotypicals, the way they communicate is more through facial language or expressions or like tone or whatnot. Because I noticed this early on, I became really self-conscious about it from a young age, and then really nervous about being misinterpreted. I guess that was one form of masking, is feeling like I had to change my or modify my intonation or like my facial expressions at the same time that I'm saying something, which I realized would be so stressful, because it's like you're already working on the main task of trying to explain whatever you're explaining or talk about what you're talking about. And then I caught myself also having to do all this math in my head. For most people, they don't realize, because for them, it comes naturally.
As someone who, it is mostly natural. Those are things that I would experience when I'm having a tough conversation with someone I care about. So I think for everyone else out there, that's the experience of sitting down with someone you're having difficulty connecting to and want to, and have feel you have to very carefully do so with. That is a slice or a snippet of what that might be like for you on a daily basis.
Yeah, exactly. So I was feeling like I had to do that. I started noticing, I guess probably by the time I was 5 or 6, maybe before, like whenever I was going to school and whatnot, I think I did start to notice, and I guess it's trial and error. I started noticing that certain expressions, if I said it a certain way, if I said it with this tone, if I said it with that tone, if I made my face like this or that.
If you put the emphasis on the right syllable, right?
Yeah, exactly. The reaction would be vastly different. And I could be saying the same exact thing, but it's just how I said it. All these little ingredients, I had to kind of mix those in there. And so there's the constant mental math of doing that and then watching the other person's reaction. So I guess there's three things. I'm speaking and then I'm doing all this math in my head. Okay, how do I convey this in the way they're gonna understand? They're not gonna misunderstand. And then the third thing is watching them. And as I'm watching them, I'll adjust. But then I can also get really confused because it's like, oh, maybe it's not working. And I don't know. And then I start getting really in my head. And then it's a whole spiral because then I'll lose track of what I'm saying or what they're saying. Because I notice this happening the other way around as well. I notice it when they're saying something and they might misunderstand or misinterpret my reaction or how it's making me feel. Because like maybe I'm just processing and I'm processing this information. And so I'm focusing on just gathering it. And so maybe my face looks different, but then they might assume that I don't understand what they're saying, or they might assume that I don't agree with them. And then I think the other big thing with masking was having to force eye contact.
You do talk about forcing eye contact quite a bit, and people mention it throughout the documentary as well, in the context of you trying so hard in what seems to you, especially when you guys are younger, the people who are on the spectrum that are part of this documentary, is managing expectations to feel safe. And it sounds like you tried to keep that in mind when you wrote the questions.
Yeah, exactly. I think also just explaining the sensory sensitivities is another thing that I remember came up a lot. And I think I had at least one question related to that, which I'm glad it came up anyways, but I don't think I had even thought of food.
People talked about clothing textures as well.
Yeah, people talked about clothing. I think even in general, that's something that most people aren't familiar with, the sensory aspect of. But I think that even when it is discussed, it's mentioned more with light and sound, because it's beyond that. Like, food sensitivities is something that I've had for a long time, and it's one of the things that it makes me sad. That's where there needs to be more understanding for sure. But a lot of people that have sensory sensitivities with food, they just get disregarded as picky eaters, or just people think it's just because we don't want to eat something, just because we don't like it, or just because it's healthy. If I try to eat something that my body does not like the texture of, trying to eat something that my body doesn't want or can't handle the texture, I'll literally start to gag. And it's even happened one or two times where I've had that reaction because I feel like someone was forcing me to eat something when my body was saying no. And then they think I'm being dramatic, because I remember this happening when I was a kid and everything. And I couldn't, it's a bummer because I couldn't even explain what it was back then. But I remember always feeling like there's something that people just don't understand. I knew I wasn't being dramatic. I knew it was something.
It's a proportional response to the texture ick that you were feeling, especially as a kid. You know, I'm not mm-hmm. saying what the texture was, but for everyone else, if they're imagining something unexpectedly slimy or something that didn't taste the way you thought it was going to be, and you're a kid, you know, you have this lizard brain reaction of, eh.
Yeah, it's like a gag or something. It's like my body is rejecting it.
Nope, not for me.
Yeah, which I don't even like getting to that point. Before I even put it in my mouth sometimes, if I can sense like, okay, this texture is not going to go well, then I won't even eat it, because I know, like, okay, I'm not even gonna put myself in that situation. I'm glad that I put that in there.
Especially with the food thing, it's an example of the, again, masking that you are trying to get people to explain, in addition to other things that other people don't see.
It's hard for them to understand from the like the sensory thing that comes with it. I think it's harder for them to grasp, yeah.
You manage to capture the difference between other people looking at what they think is someone being picky when actually it's just chaos inside that person's body or head.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because I know it comes up in the film as well. I frame autism as sometimes feeling like a different language, or the communication differences associated with being autistic. Is it's like you speak autistic and you can learn neurotypical as a second language, but it's never going to be your first language.
Masking is learning neurotypical, isn't
essentially,
it?
Yes. It's like you speak a different language, but most people don't realize that it's a different language. They think that you're just struggling to learn the language.
Well, I have an example. Actually, I have one for myself. I speak English and Russian interchangeably. I think mm-hmm. in both. I don't have any language issues when I speak English. There are certain things and phrases that I say in English.
Yeah.
Not because of neurodivergence, but because of a cultural background, that people will look at me confused.
Mm-hmm.
And they will be confused because it sounds like perfect English to them, because it is.
Mm-hmm.
But it comes from a place that they don't understand.
Yeah.
If someone comes and they have an obvious accent, which is completely mm-hmm. fine, very impressive when someone else can learn a different language, much less their own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think other people will hear that and go, oh, there's a reason this person's not doing this. But say in your case, when you're autistic, people hear you speaking, say, perfect English.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a jumping to conclusions that happens?
Yeah, I think when you say something directly, because of your tone, they might interpret it a different way. I can send you the link, or I'd be happy to send you the link. I've noticed that sometimes people can misinterpret that as, if you're too busy to search or whatever, I'll send you the link. I don't know. I legitimately mean, no, if this person is going to be able to find it otherwise, because sometimes I can't find it otherwise.
Your intention is to share information.
Yeah.
I think that's a good point, regardless of whether you're on the spectrum or not. A lot of neurodivergent people, I certainly have this where I share something or I try to give people more information because I don't think they're going to take it personally, because why would they? Maybe they're feeling a bit down. Maybe they've had a conversation with someone else where they felt put down. All of a sudden, go, well, so you think you know more than... And often I'll just say, actually, I can't remember exactly how they explained it and they do it better than me. So here is the information that I think you might find interesting. But as you're saying, they might take it as...
I think that they can't do it, or that I can do it begrudgingly. I think it happened when I was telling someone about my film. Oh, I can send it, or I'd be happy to send it. And then they were like, oh, I can look it up and find it. Or I don't remember if that's what they said afterwards, but I don't know. It came up again, where I was like, oh, I can send it. And then they're like, oh, if you don't mind. And I'm like, no, I don't.
We're trying to make people's lives easier.
Yeah. I also really wanted to shift away from stereotypical narratives such as autistic people being seen as inherently infantile, or even like as inherently innocent, which is not true either. You can still be an asshole. And inherently oblivious or gullible. Like, I've seen that kind of trope played a lot. I think that's a disconnect. People think that, oh, we're not communicating in this set way, so they must be oblivious, or the poor thing, or he's trying to learn. Let's teach him the right way of communicating. And I understand, and a lot of times people are doing it with good intentions, but it's because they don't understand that it's not that we don't know how to communicate, it's that we communicate differently.
My brother brings up, no spoilers, certain errors and pieces of culture that both he and I were brought up with about neurodivergent, and for him specifically, autistic caricatures that have become a default in thinking. High skills because of something else, but low social skills, or on the other side of this narrative spectrum, to not being able to speak or being a problem. And there is very little in between.
And there's nuances to each situation. It's complicated. But I know that a lot of people, like particularly neurotypicals, the way they communicate, instead of saying no, or I can't make it, or I don't know if I'm going to make it, they'll just not respond. For me, that makes me more stressed. Did I say something that made them feel weird?
Not the social ghosting.
Yeah, the social ghosting is frustrating. But I get it, because I guess people aren't used to the directness. It feels really discouraging when you try to communicate in the way that's not only most authentic to you, but it's actually the more direct way. And because people aren't used to that, because in most people's mind, they wouldn't do that unless they were upset.
You are trying to be as clear as possible to not have this problem, and it's creating a problem. It's part of those communication differences that you talk about. It's difficult because you're being direct to avoid miscommunication, and these are things that you think about very deeply, obviously, and people in the documentary think about, and there are still problems. And I'm not on the spectrum, so I don't have my own experience with it. I have it with my brother, who is in the documentary and has a lovely voice in the documentary. Everyone, please get ready. But he's on the spectrum, and he talks about scripting or mimicking people. And considering that you have both ADHD and are on the spectrum, and you've only previously done scripted work as a director or an actor, what was it like doing a non-scripted piece where you are, you know, as you said, thoughtfully putting out questions to provoke insightful answers that will hopefully get people to open up? But this is a new thing for you, is it not?
Yeah, it is new for sure. I like how it made it more natural. I had been used to doing mostly work like either directly from a script verbatim, or I had done something, done like improvisation off of a script, but it was still based on the basic structure of the script, of like a basic, like I would change the line around a little bit, which thankfully, like in my training, the Meisner technique that I did, it was, that's something we worked on a lot. Being able to do a script in your own words, but it was different than this. You know know basically what topics roughly might come up, but you have no idea on what the individual lines are going to be.
You don't know what the variables are, which is something that you're accustomed to in your work.
Knowing just the general idea, even if I was going off of my words. But then I guess I was able to do that. I just had to reframe it. I mean, what was helpful is I did use bullet points. So I guess like the questions that I asked everyone or the optional questions, I used that for myself as well. And it was nice. There is a part that is really freeing of not having it pre-planned. But
how much did it stress you out when I said we should probably mix people together?
I think, I don't know if it stressed me. It threw me for a loop a little bit, not in a bad way.
And may I say you were very gracious about it when I did introduce it.
Thanks. Yeah, I know.
So that's very good from a director, just so everyone knows. But I could tell that you needed some processing time, which is completely fine.
Yeah, just because like I had envisioned it in one style, and then I had to kind of morph. And then I guess that's one thing that came up with the scripted versus non-scripted, is that when it's non-scripted, you really don't know what someone's going to say and what order they're going to say it. So figuring out how to put each piece together becomes a little harder, but that's where you were really great. With that, like figuring that out, because I remember we had selected different clips that we wanted to use from different people, but then I think you did a really great job of figuring out how to put those together and how to combine them, and it turned out really great. And it's the thing that people like the most about the documentary, that back and forth of different people telling their stories. Because even though there was the logical, rational, like structured part of my brain that wanted it to be like this block, this block, this block, there was also this part that I realized this as I was watching the individual clips that I had picked, it might feel a little long.
If we didn't know these people, I obviously would try, but I can even see myself with my ADHD brain being, I get the themes, just get to the point,
I could see the same thing. I can see how this could feel dragged out for some people. I saw how it made sense to do it like you were proposing.
I also want to say you were very gracious as a director when I proposed it, and so was everyone else. Journalistically, it's an ethical gray area to take people's stories, even with the best intentions, and cut and paste them in a way that's a bit more patch quilting or something. And everyone, after we sent them a tiny clip of what we would like to do, were not just gracious, but seemed to feel it was an accurate representation. And as someone, at least for me specifically, who was nervous about doing this with people, it was incredibly validating, and I want to thank everyone for giving that much support back, because as a writer and a journalist, and someone who's been neurodivergent, has been around neurodivergent people most of my life, there's so many ways that my ADHD brain connects all the different themes, and I personally felt that it would make more sense telling a story if we had everyone else. And by the way, almost no one else other than me and Gino saw anyone else's videos before they recorded, which is what struck me the most, was if I took that raw material and had them almost talking to each other without seeing each other, I thought that might be really interesting. And everyone was really, really great about me doing that. And so I just want to thank everyone who participated, and you as well, Gino, for letting me do, because that was a huge leap from what we originally thought we were going to do.
Of course. I mean, I'm glad you suggested it. It did really make it really like engaging. I think it made it really fun and engaging. It was a great way of showing that this is an experience that a lot of these people have. The part about masking, for example, like when we're all talking about masking, we're all saying it in different ways. We're saying it in different contexts as a part of what we were talking about before.
And what I love is that you all do it, again, as I mentioned, without seeing each other's stuff. When I was doing my own, I completely forgot about everyone else's thing. Because I was focused on trying to get words together in my head instead of writing them down. But it was, the fact that so many words were common between people who weren't privy to the editing process or even had seen everyone else's videos.
Yeah.
From a journalistic perspective, I went, this is really fascinating.
Yeah, it worked so well. I wouldn't have wanted it to seem I was telling people or prompting people to say the exact same thing in the same way.
And I think there's a lot of neurodivergent back and forth talking too much stuff, which I appreciate. Yeah. I think it is when you're over-explaining, and I don't think anyone actually is over-explaining in this. I think there's an enthusiasm and a passion for being heard that in this documentary, and that probably comes from the relationships that you have forged with these people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is a testament to you creating that trust that they are willing for that to happen and are even willing for me to remix it and are okay with that.
Yeah, very grateful that I've like made these great friendships with these great people, mostly from support groups, but also extended family and some even one immediate family member, my father.
What was that like, watching your father talk about his experiences? Did he talk to you about it beforehand ever?
I think not everything. I mean, I kind of knew he had never really specifically said, oh, I started smoking weed because I had a lot of hyperactivity and I needed to calm down. Or, I mean, I knew that that was why. I kind of figured it out after a while. I was like, yeah, no, that kind of makes sense. I mean, it's funny because he didn't get diagnosed ADHD until maybe 6 or 7 years ago, but I knew that he smoked cannabis way before that. And I knew that he was hyperactive before that. It was never like, oh, this is like what led to this.
And I want to thank your father as well for being this open.
Yeah.
About, because a lot of fathers wouldn't be so crunchy. We love you.
Which, yeah, is like what is really great about my dad for sure. I mean, one of the many things.
Have you two spoken about it since then? Or?
It's never direct. I don't know. I feel like outside of the documentary, he'll never really tell me directly like, oh yeah, I had this or that because of ADHD, but I can see it. Luana, and I had to come, I had to go to the office and I was doing this and then I got distracted with this or that. And I'm like, yeah.
More open with you about things? I mean, it's been a very short time since we've put this on the internet, but do you feel it's affected your relationship in any way?
I think,
if not, you guys had an open relationship anyway, so
yeah,
that's completely fine.
Because I think we had a pretty good open relationship, but it's like, it's still cool to like see him tell it, and then because I guess I had already kind of pieced it together, but to see him tell it, and then from his perspective, and then I don't know if I remember like specific. It's just like I don't want to spoil it for people either. So probably better if I don't say what it was specifically, but like in the beginning, because one of the prompts was like, what were the first differences you noticed and so I guess to hear him talking about all of that in the context of ADHD and then now knowing that he has ADHD, and it's just like, I guess in general, like even if we're not talking about it day to day, like when I see these things and when I notice these things in him, it feels kind of cool. It's different than just observing or just kind of deducing in your head. As we talk about my dad being in the film, what was it like for you to watch your brother in the film and to edit your brother? Did it bring anything up for you that hadn't come up before?
Oh, it did. Alex, I hope you never have to listen to this because I'm about to compliment you. He has such a lovely voice. He really does. It's upsetting. And he's worked so hard on doing, and he mentions this in the documentary, trying to figure out how to use his voice and his face, and he's just so good at it, and I wish it wasn't so painful for him to figure out who he has become. He is my best friend. We fought a lot, but he is my best friend, and he is an absolute joy to edit, but it did bring up a lot of memories I did remember, but I hadn't thought about in over a decade and a half. Being there with him and going through kind of emotional relationship 101 with the therapist and some very unhelpful things that she did and some helpful things. I don't like to say proud of him. For me, proud kind of makes me feel like I'm responsible for some of it. I was there. I was a kid. I'd like to say I tried to help, but that's all him.
Yeah.
And I know he tries really hard. And there's this one moment where he talks about his nuclear cool down playlist.
Yes.
And I know his face so well. And he does this little side grin.
Yeah,
with himself
like
on camera, and it just made me, I had to pause it, and it almost made me cry, really, how happy it made me. He was like, I have this playlist called Nuclear Cool Down, and then he just sort of does this grin.
Yeah.
Like, it's an awesome playlist title.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, yeah, that's, you should be proud of that. You absolutely should be. And it just brought me so much joy. I watched that over and over and over.
Yeah, it was a really good moment, because it's just really authentic, and like, yeah, like, that's, I know, it's a,
I'm awesome. I'm like, you are.
Yeah.
And to hear him talk about things that even I didn't know he remembered when he was first diagnosed, it wasn't being autistic, it was a developmental disorder. I didn't know he remembered that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And to hear him talk about things that I haven't talked to him about in that context or that specifically in years because we've both been there, so why talk about it? We just sort of share memories of trauma experiences and make jokes about it. We don't specifically talk about it anymore because we were both there. To hear him say it, it made me very emotional in a good way. I think he's amazing.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm really glad that he was down to participate in the documentary. I feel like he touched on every one of the optional questions or like topics or whatnot, and in a great way, just explained it.
He got the masking down.
Yeah.
That's masking.
Yeah.
It's an art. He's made his existence an art.
Yeah.
And that's what I find so, not necessarily admirable, because people shouldn't have to do that. I mean, I understand because I've been in a similar situation with the ADHD, but not quite to the extent he does. He and I both have this performance aspect of our lives that we're trying to mediate at the moment. And the way he's managed to do it with more challenges than I've had to deal with in his case is really spectacular. I call him the dude.
The dude.
Like from the Big Lebowski. In my family, we call him the dude.
I also feel like really close with my dad, and I do feel like he's probably my best friend as well. Realizing that there was a lot of kind of like masking and kind of like negative feedback and things that he had to deal with as well.
He had to feel like he had to cover some things up.
Yeah, like covering up or just feeling really ashamed. Or I still kind of catch that sometimes where, I mean, just like as a trauma response where he's like embarrassed or ashamed about being late or getting excited or talking or interrupting. Like we all do that, but I guess it's just, because I can see that too. Like I can see
The thinking.
And so there's that part that's sad too that I'm like, darn it. Like, I mean, not only does he have a lot of these same things that I have or that I noticed, but he also had to go through a lot of this kind of masking stuff, but even maybe more so because he grew up decades before I did. And the environment, there was like, even like way, way, and he mentions it in the documentary also that there was a lot, lot less understanding.
It is incredibly difficult. And again, what you were talking about, the grace that we have to have for ourselves and for the information that we have. And also reminding ourselves that now that we have more information, there is a line to that grace. If you have access to that information, if, say, people like you or me are in your family and we're giving you access to this information and you decide to do nothing about it and to continue hurting people around you, that is now on you. I think it is an important point to make that when we have people like you and me who spend lots of our time researching, making sure that our sources are accurate, there is so much more information. We're so careful about how we are filtering it and communicating to people, which a lot of other people with platforms do not do. There is a point at which if people in our inner circle have that information and decide to do nothing with it.
Yeah, exactly. It's
on them. And also have the financial ability to say, go get help, right? Because not everyone else does. But if they do, or they don't know where to turn to, or they decide to do nothing, that's quite damning for them. And it's sad to watch, but there's nothing you and I can do. And what's great about your family, my family, is that all of them, thanks to privilege, also deciding that they needed to do better for their children. These are all huge decisions that they had to make that probably affected their ego and themselves and their sense of worth. They decided to do it.
Yeah.
It's not that it's not scary. I have a lot of respect for the fact that they would do that.
Yeah, me too. Okay, I know it's not always the case. I know that there are a lot of people that have a really hard time, a really strained relationship with their family because their family doesn't try to understand.
There is a lot of intention that has to be present and the need to better oneself. I think with the information we have, depending on your financial status, what kind of privilege you have, your access to information and resources, you and I are talking from a place of a lot of privilege. I want to make it very clear that anyone listening to this where your parents did not have that and are trying or didn't want to, or you don't know how to talk to them about it, that is what it is. And that's not because of them. Sometimes it might be. There are a lot of parents who don't do that because they have information, just decide that it makes them too uncomfortable.
Yeah, yeah. I know sometimes it's because they don't have the information, but I know that it does happen a lot that they'll have the information and they'll still be like really uncomfortable.
That makes sense because then they have to rethink their entire life and they might not want to do that.
Yeah.
And that's a choice. That's really hard for their kids.
Yeah.
I think if, you know, the best thing a person can do, if you're a newly diagnosed neurodivergent or self-diagnosed, or your parents are reeling from the realization that they too might be neurodivergent because you're neurodivergent, the best thing you can do is try and keep an open conversation and know that as long as you provide answers for them or try to give them space, you're doing the best you can. They can and you can. And if they don't respond in the same way, that's not on you.
Yeah, it's, I see kind of how it can be hard to not internalize it. I know, especially when people are just discovering that they're autistic or ADHD, I know that imposter syndrome happens a lot, and then it's just unfortunate that a lot of times they go to tell their family and their family.
Jessica talks about this in the documentary as well, that
yeah.
Her family, she was the first one to diagnose herself, said that mm-hmm. Oh, she was just the youngest,
mm-hmm.
Or the therapist said that she made eye contact and quote-unquote had empathy, which you've talked about extensively, how frustrating it is to hear that.
Yeah, because people assume that, because we don't show it in the same traditional way most people are used to it, then they think that we don't have it. Emotionally, I feel even, it feels like I feel more empathy than most people, but...
And you have to learn to regulate it
mm-hmm.
much more than a lot of people do in order to make sure the people around you know you care.
Yeah.
You're doing that little bit of extra effort.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that's important, because if you didn't, that would be sad.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I didn't have to, but...
Yeah, you actually care about the person.
Yeah, but it's annoying. Like, I do wish, like, I do really hope that at one point we get to a point where people don't have to do that necessarily, where there's enough understanding about these different ways of communicating, and so there doesn't have to be like all this effort put into like trying to regulate how you're saying something, that you can just say something and be some way and be understood.
I think the language point you made earlier is a great explanation, which is that as, for example, as the world has become more connected, more international, more connected to other cultures, more connected to other languages, people have, not very well, but some people have started to make space for, oh, this person's trying to connect with me, but they don't have the language, they have their own language.
Yeah.
One of the things that I really enjoyed about what your father contributed, as someone who just has ADHD, as do I, was his motor metaphor. So for context, I've heard a lot of vehicle metaphors and similes about ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I'd heard them all. I've heard the ones about having a Ferrari motor but having tricycle wheels. I've heard ADHD is like being on a train with no railway. Those things did bother me a little bit, the Ferrari and the tricycle wheels in particular, because it's not so much that I can't do it, it's that, or that I don't have the materials for it, which is what that implies, is that everything around me is not supporting me.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the things that your father used that is motor-related that I did end up cutting together, and I felt so seen whilst I did it, is him talking about starting at a certain speed with ADHD and being asked to park in that same speed.
Yeah.
And that really resonated with me, because one of the things that I get told to this day is, oh, you need to calm down.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing too much, or you're getting too excited, or why can't you just chill?
Yes, I've been asked that as well.
It's not that I can't, but if I'm supposed to be around people I'm friends with, and it's an appropriate situation, everyone's sharing, I'm going to go faster mentally than other people. And I spend a lot of time trying to make sure that I ask people questions, not because I have to mentally think about it, but because I've raced ahead and I go, oh, I'm actually interested in what this person has to say. I have to go back to what I thought. But it's the parking metaphor that your father used. I don't have a park.
It's like he said, like, trying to park a car at 20 miles an hour or something like that.
Or and when everyone's around you, and if it works, like as a journalist, it works, right? But it also burns you out. And so having to learn how to not have people take advantage of that and then tell you off for when you can't stop is very difficult.
Yeah.
When you are going at whatever miles an hour from I get up, I'm just there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that often happens with me as well. It's a struggle sometimes because, like, it really is about regulation. Sometimes it's not enough dopamine and sometimes it's too much dopamine. Societally, there's a lot of focus on the not enough dopamine part. It's not just that. The opposite can happen. I can also have too much, and then I can't slow down, even if I want to slow down.
The fact that even in different generations, your father and I could be edited together.
Yeah, no, because that was really cool. That was another part of the documentary that I really liked.
I felt like I was talking to your dad in that moment.
Yeah, I felt like when I was watching, I felt like you two were talking to each other. I'm sure that some people would probably assume it was scripted just because it was well done.
We're touching on such similar themes. And it's because our shared experience as people with ADHD is different but similar, even in different generations, even coming from different countries. What you've, I think, done such a great job with, and I'm, again, very glad to be a part of, is finding people who feel comfortable talking about it in a way that, for me as an editor, made it really easy to find the connections in those stories, genuine and not forced. We're just talking to each other without actually seeing each other. And I think that's part of this documentary, is we just so desperately want to connect to each other, and we are. But it's so difficult to do that without pushback and without being acknowledged. And that's all we're asking. So I really do thank you for the opportunity to work on this and to work with you, because it was really, really fun.
I'm grateful that you are also willing to do it and take on the time.
It was my pleasure. It was absolutely my pleasure.
The short documentary is going to be screened at the Sanford Meisner Film Festival with 2025 in San Francisco, California.
You will be there to answer questions.
Yes, I will be there answering questions, given the exorbitant cost and also logistics of air travel from the UK to San Francisco. X, unfortunately, won't be able to make it, but I will be there answering questions. And then also for anyone who wants to watch the, anyone else who can't make it and wants to watch the film on YouTube, I will be linking that as well.
And that is completely free.
Yes. So thank you once again, everyone, for listening. Welcome back to Unpacking Neuroqueerness. And I hope you enjoyed this episode of us kind of giving the insight of how we made this documentary. And then more importantly, I hope you enjoyed the documentary as well.